versus and versus the Educational Credit Management Company. Non-payment of the student loan.
That's correct, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Dan Fisher. I represent ECMC, the appellant in this matter. ECMC asserts that at the time of trial, the debtor met no prong of the Bruner test, which has been incorporated into this circuit's case law through Roberson and the most recent case in Ray Goulet. This Court reviews the Bankruptcy Court's decision de novo. This Court has articulated the appropriate standard to be used in the student loan dischargeability cases under the undue hardship standard of 11 U.S.C. Section 523A.
What do we review de novo?
You review de novo the Bankruptcy Court's conclusions of law, i.e., that the debtor met his burden of proof under the statute 523A8.
So on the ultimate issue of undue burden, we use de novo review.
The ultimate issue of whether this debtor met his burden of proof of an undue hardship is reviewed de novo by this court.
There are some other issues, though, besides adjudicative facts in this case. We have to decide whether or not he could maintain a, under the test we had in Robson, whether or not we could he could keep a minimum standard of living and pay off the loans, whether there's been a good faith attempt to pay those loans, whether the situation, I know I'm not giving them to you in order, is whether or not the situation is going to be chronic and last for a while.
Right.
On those issues, what standard of review do we use?
Each of those issues, as this Court has articulated in Roberson, those are the three prongs, and I believe
yeah.
you gave them in 1-3-2 order.
That's right.
If the court, debtor does not meet his burden under any of the prongs, the analysis stops there. So
what standard of review does this court use on each of those questions I articulated, on each of those prongs?
Each of those prongs is an issue of law. The underlying facts supporting those prongs are findings of fact to be reviewed as a clear error standard.
How do you square that with cases like from the Supreme Court like Underwood? I mean, is this really an issue where we have the same ability to look at the record as the bankruptcy court did?
Yes and no. Yes in that you have the same ability to look at the record in the bankruptcy court's conclusions of law and findings of fact. Obviously, it's going to be different because Mr. O'Hearn is not here to testify and you're not going to be able to judge his
credibility. So, for instance, on the issue of good faith, I mean, do I have the same ability to assess his good faith as the bankruptcy judge did?
As a matter of law, you do. Now, what you would review under the clearly erroneous standard is the fact that the bankruptcy court has an obligation to find under the bankruptcy rules.
How about whether the man's going to have this problem for a long, long time? Is that something an appellate judge can look at as well as a bankruptcy judge?
It absolutely is, and in fact, this court has done so twice in the last 10 years, in the Roberson case and the Goulet case, and in both of those cases, this court has reversed the bankruptcy court's, or in Mr. Roberson's case, it was the district court's decision that the debtor has met the undue hardship, and both of those cases were overturned on a legal basis because of the second prong of the Bruner test. So I would suggest that each individual prong is reviewed de novo. The facts supporting those prongs are reviewed for clear error standard. And ECMC asserts that the bankruptcy court here clearly erred in three issues. Number one, that $3,000 per month in housing and utility costs equals a minimal standard of living for two people. The only evidence on the record was the evidence introduced by ECMC articulating the IRS standards that a reasonable cost of living in the Portland area where these folks have subsequently moved, the reasonable cost of living for housing and utilities was $837. The court said that $3,000 a month for these two folks to live in a four-bedroom house is a minimal standard of living. We respectfully suggest this was a clearly erroneous fact. The second one was that there were additional circumstances under the second prong of the Bruner test that would preclude the debtor from paying these student loans. This court has articulated in Roberson that these additional circumstances include things like mental problems, physical problems, and other long-term chronic issues. In this case, the debtor was 50 years old. He was highly educated. He was working in his field, making $43,000 a year. The debtor had employer-provided health care and dental care and retirement funds. There were no additional circumstances.
You say he had a retirement fund in the job he is presently in?
At the time of trial, he was employed, and his employer would contribute 5% of his salary to a retirement fund.
Did he have anything left from the retirement savings from before that job?
No, sir. The record indicates that the debtor gave a power of attorney to his tax preparer, who had absconded with tens of thousands.
So he was in a situation where, at his age, he was going to have to try to somehow or another make that up if he was going to have any kind of a retirement. Am I right?
That's correct. He would have to rely on Social Security and his new employer's health. Retirement plan.
Now, you said at the time of trial, does he still have that job?
I have no idea. There are the facts that we have before us are the facts.
From the way you phrase that, I wondered.
But I'm sorry, sir. I have absolutely no indication. I'm assuming that it is.
What do you make of Judge McGarrity's point that, he may be paying a little bit more for rent than he has to pay, but he's really saving on a variety of other things, including on that car loan. It probably balances out.
I think that's somewhat, to put it benevolently, I believe that's somewhat disingenuous. For two folks to pay $3,000 a month in housing and utility costs for a four-bedroom home with no children, I don't see how the scales balance out. The fact that he pays $115 a month for his car just does not equal the costs that he could be saving if he lived in a more reasonably priced or a more modestly priced apartment. And we're not talking about putting Mr. O'Hearn into poverty. We're talking about holding him to the minimal standard of living that this court has articulated, the standard for discharging someone's student loans. And this court, I would also suggest, should find that the bankruptcy court erred in its legal conclusions, and I think for that we should very, very briefly review the three cases that we have that are important in this case, the Roberson case, the Goulet case, and then the case at bar, Mr. O'Hearn. Gary Roberson had no income at the time of trial. He had two DUIs and $500 a month in child support. This court said that his near-term future was bleak, but reversed the discharge of his loans because he hadn't shown the certainty of hopelessness required. John Goulet was a 55-year-old debtor who lives with his mother. He had $228 a month in child support obligations and $80,000 in student loan debt. This court similarly reversed the discharge of a student loan, noting that the record is devoid of any evidence demonstrating that his problems are insurmountable. And in this case, Mr. O'Hearn has no dependents. He made $43,000 at the time of trial. He lived with his fiancée, who made similarly approximately $43,000. They lived in a four-bedroom house. They split the $3,000 a month housing and utility costs, and this house was purchased by his fiancée for $380,000. Mr. O'Hearn has medical and dental insurance through his employer, and yet the bankruptcy court indicated that one of the additional circumstances was dental problems and some lingering health care issues. And Mr. O'Hearn also testified at trial he has no medical issues that would preclude him from earning a living. I see my time is up. I wish to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal, subject to questions of the court.
May it please the court, I am Christine Wolk. I am the attorney for the appellee, Timothy G. O'Hearn. And we are requesting that this court affirm the decision of the district court dismissing the appeal of the ECMC, the Educational Corporation.
Does the record establish that he had no equity at all in this house?
No, he has no equity in this house.
But he's paying half the house, but has no equity.
Correct. The home that
really be in love.
Or need
either
a place to live.
Darn fool.
The equity in this home was from a home that Ms. DeMarco owned in Madison, Wisconsin. So when she sold her home, she rolled her equity into the home in Portland. She's not entitled to any of her equity there.
Do we know how much equity she has in the house?
I do not know, no. That house, in fact, has since sold.
Why isn't that in this record for the bankruptcy court?
That it's sold?
What? How much equity she has in the house?
I don't know. I mean, it wasn't I didn't provide that evidence to the court. It wasn't Mr. O'Hearn's equity. They are not married.
I know. We're talking about how much each one of them has to pay each month into it.
Correct.
That seems to be a part of the equation.
It's a major part of the equation. It's the primary objection that the appellant has. It is their primary focus. But the rest of his expenses are extremely minimal. As the appellant stated, the standard is whether or not the findings of fact be set aside is clearly erroneous. And I think that the bankruptcy court was in the best position to evaluate the situation. That court had the opportunity to listen to the testimony of Mr. O'Hearn. While he has no current health conditions due to his service in Africa as a public health administrator, he does have malaria. This is something you can't predict when it's going to reoccur. He testified that he has issues with glaucoma, which is a side effect of the anti-malarial medications that he had to take. And once he came back from his service in Africa, he essentially had to start all over again. He had nothing left. The power of attorney had rolled over his IRA into a business early on. We didn't discover it until much later. The power of attorney had waited just until 2 months before Mr. O'Hearn returned and took the remaining $25,000 worth of funds that were in the Riggs Bank account in Washington, D.C., and converted it to another business, which he then filed bankruptcy on. The power of attorney.
Let me ask you just a question about that.
Certainly.
He had made a $30,000 settlement offer.
Correct.
Now, ordinarily, we don't know those sorts of things, and it's inadmissible under the rules of evidence. But it's certainly an interesting thing in this case why the collection agency didn't accept that. Why is the rule different here as far as the court knowing about this settlement?
Because when we're looking at the standards under the Brunner standards, we're looking at good faith and bad faith. And good faith isn't just on the side of the debtor. I believe good faith should also be evaluated from the good faith of the school loan creditor. And the evidence that, and in fact, I think the testimony was he offered $30,000 plus payment. They wouldn't take the downstroke. As to whether
I
or not.
I thought it was $30,000 plus a lien on that judgment against the account.
The decision in the.
I thought it was that too.
That's what the offer was?
Yeah.
No. The decision. The school, ECMC now, under the decision of the bankruptcy court, is entitled to any proceeds received under the judgment. The debt was discharged with the proviso that if Mr. O'Hearn collects any funds from Mr. Peterson, who was his power of attorney, that money must go to the school loan creditor until it's paid.
There's no incentive for him to do it.
Well, there's a judgment of $70,000. And I'm sorry, the judgment, and then there's a punitive judgment that doubles that and adds it on. So there's incentive to collect $250,000. And in fact, we offered to assign the judgment, and it is the school loan creditor's opinion that, or their statement in court that they had no, that Mr. O'Hearn had no incentive, so why should they collect it, even though they're a collection agency and would be in a better position to collect it. There's a judgment in place. All they need is a certified copy of it. They don't require any other assistance from Mr. O'Hearn. He's done all the testifying that's necessary. It's a solid judgment.
Would the bankruptcy judge have had the authority to condition discharge ability on paying the $30,000?
I think that's sort of split, that there are partial discharges. Some of the circuits do allow partial discharge based on... I don't think she could have ordered that, no.
Pardon me?
I don't think she could have ordered the settlement amount.
Why could she have ordered the $30,000 to be turned over, and with, as he asked about, and a partial discharge?
Well, one, the $30,000 no longer existed at the time of trial.
When he made the offer, it didn't exist?
The offer was made prior to him even filing bankruptcy. It was made with the funds that he still had available from a personal injury settlement when he returned from Africa, and that from funds he was going to borrow. But he did not anticipate the difficulty in finding employment. And he
The debt didn't mean that much to him. He just went out and spent the money.
He had to live at that on that money. To say that the debt didn't mean that much to him, he lived at a level of $400 to $600 a month while he was in Africa and sent all of his money back to the POA.
That had nothing to do with his debt now. And he gets $30,000 from an accident settlement, and he can't pay anything, and pay that debt off?
I'm sorry.
Any part of it?
The personal injury settlement was in 1974. What remained was $15,000 when he returned from Africa. And he did offer the $15,000 as part of that 30, which was rejected prior to the bankruptcy filing.
Interesting case.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Only that I request that this court affirm the decision of the district court.
Your Honor, very briefly in rebuttal, I would like to address several of your questions that I don't know were forcefully or completely answered. First of all, the equity in the house, as testified at the time of trial, was purchased for $385,000. The mortgage was approximately $345,000. So there was somewhere in the area of, my math escapes me, but I believe it's $45,000 equity at the time of the house, at the time of the trial
but
in the house. I'm sorry?
But it's not his equity.
It is not his equity, and I believe that's interesting because he was essentially building her equity through his half payments of the mortgage.
His payments each month.
That's correct. That's correct. Debtor's counsel indicated that the ECMC should have more of an interest as we're a collection agency. I want to clarify for the court that we are not a collection agency. We're a guarantee agency under the highly regulated Family Federal Education Loan Program. And as such, we do not have the ability to collect debts like this judgment. We can collect student loans under our charter agreement with the Department of Education, and there's nothing in the Higher Education Act or the federal regulations allowing for this extraneous debt collection. And lastly, Your Honor, I believe you had indicated about partial discharges. The Ninth Circuit last week decided a case called In re Saxman that said that the court in the Ninth Circuit, at least, and I believe this is the majority opinion now, the court can partially discharge a student loan case if and only if the court satisfies each and every prong of the Bruner test. And that is consistent with this court's decision in Roberson and Goulet that state that if the debtor doesn't meet the first prong, we stop and go home. If he does, we go on to the second prong. If not, we stop and go home, et cetera, et cetera. And I believe that if and only if the debtor meets all three prongs of Bruner and Roberson, they can partially discharge, which we respectfully suggest has not been met. Subject to the court's questions, thank you.
Thank you for your help as well. We will proceed to